When Percy Martin woke up at about 2 o'clock in the morning, the two girls were gone. The men were still here, but all five of them were passed out drunk. Martin went through their pockets to take what money they had, then he left. Less than half an hour after Martin left, the two girls, Betsy and Carol, returned, leading at least 10 armed men.
That's them!
Betsy pointed at the sleeping figures. The self-appointed leader of the posse was a man named Jim Abell. He walked over to the closest sleeping man and kicked him hard in the side.
Get up! Get up, you son of a bitch!
What is it? What do you want?
What's your name?
Abell held a shotgun leveled toward the man on the ground.
Tinker. Gerald Tinker. Who are you?
I'm the man that's going to hang your sorry ass, along with all your friends. Get up, now! All of you!
By now, the others were awake, and gradually they began to stand.
You too!
Abell glared at one of the men who had made no effort to stand.
Won't do you no good to yell at him. That's Harry Evers. He ain't gonna stand.
Oh? And why won't he stand?
He ain't gonna stand because he's dead. Percy Martin killed him.
Which one is Percy Martin?
Tinker looked at the other four men.
He ain't here. He's gone.
One of the other men pulled his pockets inside out.
Hey, my money's all gone.
Tinker checked his pockets.
Mine too.
Martin, that son of a bitch took all our money.
Even before John Henry reached the town of Lodore that afternoon, he saw the frenzied activity of buzzards ahead. There were too many of them for it to be something small. He might have thought they were gathering around a dead horse or cow, except for the way they were behaving. These buzzards were flying in circles, only rarely committing to a diving attack to whatever it was that had drawn them. John Henry knew, even before he reached the town, that the buzzards were circling a human corpse. The fact that buzzards were frightened of men, even when they were dead, caused them to be somewhat hesitant. He knew also, though, that once they got over their initial fear, they would make fairly quick work of the corpse. As he came farther into town, he saw what had attracted the buzzards. Stopping, he subconsciously ran his finger down the lightning bolt flash of the scar on his face and studied the scene before him. It wasn't just one corpse that had attracted the buzzards, for there in front of him, suspended from a long and solid branch of a hackberry tree, were five men. They were hanging by their necks, their heads crooked to one side in the way peculiar to a hanged man. There had been nothing in Marshal Sarber's instructions that mentioned a lynching. Also, these corpses looked fresh. Neither buzzard attacks nor decomposition had yet sullied the corpses. As he rode by the dangling men, he saw that a sign had been pinned to one of them. These five men were murderers and rapists. Hanging was too good for them. Technically, Lodore was not a town, in that it had not been incorporated. And because it was not a town, it had neither law nor a court. Therefore, it appeared to John Henry that the five men had been lynched. His first thought was that their deaths were somehow connected with the competition between the railroads to be the first to reach the border of the Indian Territory. But that would not explain the sign that referred to them as murderers and rapists. When someone saw John Henry paying attention to the five suspended corpses, he rode out to meet him. That was when he saw the badge on John Henry's chest.
I see by the badge that you're the law. May I inquire as to what branch of law you represent?
I'm John Henry Sixkiller, United States Marshal. And you are?
My name is Jim Abell, sir. Now, I must say, I thought what we did might attract the law, but I didn't expect anyone to come this quickly.
Oh?
No, sir, I did not, seeing as we only strung these men up this very morning.
They do look fresh.
How'd you find out about it?
I saw them hanging here.
No, I mean, how'd you hear about them?
Abell took in the five hanging men with a motion of his hand.
I didn't hear about them. I knew nothing about them until I saw them hanging here.
This isn't what brought you here?
Nope.
I see. Well, seeing as you are a U.S. Marshal and all, I figured you were here because of this. Does this mean you aren't planning to look into it?
You aren't going to try and say they were legally hanged, are you?
As legal as you can get in Lodore, seeing as we have no law.
Lynching is never legal.
They weren't exactly lynched. We gave them a trial of sorts. It was a people's court, you might say.
What did they do?
They commenced yesterday by beating up and robbing several of our townspeople. 7 of them there were then. But that wasn't enough for them. No, sir. They topped it off last night by nearly pistol-whipping to death Ed Roach, one of our citizens. Then, with poor old Mr. Roach lying near dead on the floor, they took his 2 girls with them out into the woods. What they did to those 2 poor, innocent girls isn't even fit to talk about.
How did you catch them?
That wasn't hard at all. They got drunk and passed out, and the girls escaped. As soon as we found out about it, we just went out to the little patch of woods where the girls said it happened, and sure enough, there they were, drunk as skunks. All we had to do was pick them up.
But you said you had a trial.
We did have a trial, right back there in the saloon. Mr. Roach, even though his head is all wrapped up in bandages, came over to testify, and he identified him. His 2 girls did, too. And they also told us what all these men did to them. It was something terrible to hear, I tell you.
Tell me more about the trial. Did you have a judge, jury? Did you have lawyers for the prosecution and defense?
Yes, sir, we did. And the 2 men we had be the defense and prosecuting attorneys both have college educations, too.
You said there were 7 of them. But there are only 5 here. Where are the other 2?
There's only 1 more of them. One of them got himself killed, and we have his body down at the lumber yard where the coffins are being built. We'll be burying him alongside these. The one that killed him was a man by the name of Percy Martin. Martin is the one that got away.
I see.
Look here, Marshal, if you didn't come here to look into this legal hanging, what did you come here for?
Federal court has taken an interest in the competition between the 2 railroads.
Oh. Well, in that case, I expect you'll want to talk to either Colonel Stevens or Mr. Gunn or Mr. Scullin. But none of them are here. If you want to talk to them, you'll have to go up to Emporia. But if you'd like, I can get you on the next train that will be going back for supplies. That'll be in about an hour from now, and it'll have you in Emporia by supper time.
What about my horse?
Well, you can board him here if you want. Curly Latham runs the livery. He'll take good care of him.
All right. Thanks, I may do that.
You know the lynching?
If you're telling the truth, Mr. Abel, the entire town was in on it.
Yes, sir. Like I said, we had a trial and everything.
How many people live here in Lodore?
Yeah, we've never taken an actual count, but we figure it has to be somewhere between 200 and 300 people.
I can't very well arrest 200 people for lynching now, can I? And the only difference between 200 people here holding a trial and 200 people in an incorporated town holding a trial would be some paperwork. Sometimes looking the other way, Mr. Abel, may be the wisest part of discretion.
Yes, sir.
Abel let a big, relieved smile spread across his face.
I've always said that same thing.
I would not recommend you hold any more trials before you get yourself incorporated.
Yes, sir, I think that is a very good suggestion. And I can tell you that it's highly unlikely that such a thing would ever happen again.
When John Henry stepped down from the train in Emporia, he was met by Colonel Stevens.
Marshal Sixkiller, I am Colonel Stevens, president of the Katy Railroad. It's good to see you, sir, and welcome to Emporia.
You were expecting me?
Mr. Bell sent a telegram informing me that you were coming. I've arranged a dinner for you where you will meet Mr. Gunn and Mr. Scullin, my 2 top men. We may as well make your visit as pleasant as possible while we are discussing business.
You won't get an argument from me.
John Henry accompanied Colonel Stevens to the restaurant, where in a corner in the back a special table had been laid out. Here John Henry met Otis Gunn and John Scullin, as well as 2 prominent Cherokees, Colonel Boudinot and General Stan Watty, both of whom had earned their military appellations when they served in those positions in the Confederate Army during the Civil War. John Henry knew both of them well, and they knew him. Boudinot took John Henry's hand.
John Henry, I haven't seen you since you were appointed U.S. Marshal. Congratulations.
Thank you, Colonel.
John Henry nodded towards Stan Watty, the other Cherokee.
General, my respects, sir.
Captain Sixkiller.
Though as chief sheriff of the Cherokee, John Henry was a captain in the Indian police, he knew that General Watty was referring to the rank John Henry attained during the war.
Gentlemen, I've invited Marshal Sixkiller to have dinner with us tonight so he could speak to us about the role of the U.S. Marshal in our race to get the railroad to the Indian Territory before Joy and his group get there.
It's too late for that.
What are you talking about?
James Joy and his Border Tier Railroad have reached Baxter Springs.
The hell you say? This is the first that I've heard about it. When did it happen?
Just a few hours ago.
Then it's over. All is lost.
Unexpectedly, Boudinot smiled.
No, it isn't.
It isn't? What do you mean? How can this be anything but a disaster?
The border tier has reached Baxter Springs. Most people consider Baxter Springs to be right on the territory line. And indeed, they even advertise themselves as such. But in fact, it isn't. It is actually a whole mile from the border. So far, Joy doesn't know this. And I'm told he has halted all work and they're going to sit there until after the party next week, celebrating the victory.
Next week? Well, that's no good. That's too far away. Joy is sure to learn that he isn't actually at the line before then, and how long will it take him to go a mile?
And how is he to learn? As an official representative of the Cherokee Nation, I have already welcomed him into the territory, and I will be furnishing everything his workers might need for a wild party. Food, drink. I even arranged to have some women come down from Wichita. The Honorable I.S. Kalik, famous politician and orator, is going to speak. I expect before the day is over that you won't find a sober worker within 20 miles of the place.
Still, he has only a mile to go. He can do that in a day. We still have 30 miles to go.
We haven't told you the best part.
Stan Watty rubbed his hands together.
Even if he does cross the line, it won't matter.
Why not?
He thinks he's opposite Cherokee land, where the right-of-way has already been negotiated with the government. But he isn't. He's opposite Shawnee territory. Even if he crosses from where he is, it will do him no good, because he has no right to be there. The Shawnee have not granted permission to enter their land, and they'll be turned back. Then, they will have to reroute for 23 miles back to Chitopa in order to cross the border where it is legal.
Otis Gunn, Stevens's construction manager, shifted in his seat.
We aren't out of the woods yet, boss. We're still 30 miles from Chitopa, and that's farther than the border tier will have to go to make up for their mistake.
Scullin perked up.
I have a suggestion. Let's hire as many of the border tier railroad track workers as we can, just to deny them to Mr. Joy. Once he finds out his mistake, he's going to have to go like hell to get there. But if we've hired away enough of his men, he won't have the labor source to do it.
Gentlemen, we are going to reach Chitopa 3 weeks from today, or by damn, I am going to know the reason why. General Water, Colonel Boudinot, you tell the folks in Chitopa that when our tracks cross into Cherokee Nation, that I will throw a party for the entire town, and I'll give every man, woman, and child a free railroad ride to Russell Creek and back.
The railroad business discussed, Stevens turned to John Henry, who, during the discussion, had been enjoying a rare restaurant-prepared meal. He had just carved off a piece of beef and put it in his mouth when Stevens turned to him.
I'm sorry, Marshal Sixkiller. I invited you to dinner, then ignored you to take care of business. Now, perhaps you can tell us what brings you to Emporia.
John Henry held up his hand to signal that he would answer as soon as he chewed his food.
I've been told that the competition between your railroad and the Border Tier Railroad has resulted in some destruction of property. Marshal Sarber is concerned that it might get out of hand and that some people might get hurt, or even killed. If that happens, it could spread out to endanger some innocent civilians.
Marshal, I admit that when we first started this little race, there were a few incidents. But now both Joy and I are convinced that the first trouble, the most damaging trouble, was not done by the Border Tier or the Katy Line. I didn't do it. He says he didn't do it, and I believe it. We think it was some outsiders who wrecked the Border Tier work train and burned our store of supplies.
Why would an outsider do that?
You've got me there, Marshal. I mean, if it was someone who wanted the Border Tier to beat us, why, they wouldn't have wrecked the Border Tier train now, would they? And the same thing in reverse. If it was someone who wanted the Katy to succeed, why would they burn our supplies? No, sir, it has to be someone outside. And, say, maybe this is where you can fit in. Maybe you can find out who it is that's doing this.
That is my job, Colonel Stevens. I fully intend to find out who's at the bottom of this.
I will make you this solemn promise. The Katy Railroad will fully cooperate with you in your investigation. And we also stand ready to assist you in any way we can.
Thank you, Colonel Stevens. I appreciate that.
John Henry spent the night in Emporia, then the next day took the Frisco line to Paola, which would connect him with the Border Tier line. A private car sat in the depot to be attached to the train when it arrived. The car belonged to Charles Beam, one of the principal investors in the Border Tier Line. Beam wanted to see for himself that the railroad had reached the border of the Indian Territory. A half hour later, the train arrived.
Six Killer? That is a rather unusual name. Sounds almost Indian.
That's understandable, Mr. Beam, seeing as my father was Indian.
Oh, my word. You don't look Indian.
By not looking Indian, do you mean I'm not wearing a war bonnet and I don't have my face painted?
Why,
Beam stopped, and a sheepish smile spread across his face.
Well, I guess you got me there, friend. I'm sorry if I offended you.
I'm not offended.
A station clerk approached.
Mr. Beam, will you be wanting your car to remain in Baxter Springs for a while?
Beam went over to speak with the railroad official while John Henry took a seat. Fifteen miles south of Paola, Percy Martin and three others sat waiting. One of Martin's men scratched his whiskers and looked down at the track.
Are you sure this train is carrying money?
There's nearly 200 railroad workers down in Baxter Springs.
So?
So they have to be paid. More than likely the payroll's on the train.
More than likely don't mean it's on the train. Just means that more than likely it is.
Peters, if you don't want to be a part of this, you're free to ride away now.
Peters' partner picked up Percy's point.
Look here, Peters. I think Martin is right. And even if the train ain't carrying a payroll, why, it's gonna have passengers on it, and you know they got money.
I ain't riding away. I was just asking, is all.
You got that wood ready to light?
Yeah, but why are we gonna light it? If we leave it just the way it is, it'll wreck the train, and it'll be easy pickings.
Think so, do you? You ever walk through a rail car when it's lying on its side?
No, can't say as I have.
Can't say that you have, because it can't be done. If we're going to be taking money from the passengers, then we need cars we can walk through. Now get it lit soon as we hear the train coming. I want the engineer to see it, plenty of time to stop.
All right. It's all ready to light.
Better get it lit now. I hear it coming.
They'd been underway for almost an hour. John Henry, who'd been dozing in his seat, tried to look through the window. But because it was dark outside, because the inside was illuminated with gimbal-mounted coal-oil lanterns, the only thing he saw in the window was his own reflection. The passenger struggled to his feet.
What is it? Why did we suddenly stop like this? There's no depot here. If this is how James Joy is planning on running his railroad once he gets it built all the way through to Texas, he certainly won't get my business.
John Henry was unable to see what was going on outside, but he had a gut instinct as to what was happening, so he pulled his pistol and then covered it with his hat. Almost immediately, a man stepped into the car from the front. He was wearing a white hood pulled down over his face, with only his eyes showing. The mask hid the man's identity, but John Henry knew it would also restrict the robber's vision somewhat.
Everyone stay in their seats!
The man brandished a pistol. The angry passenger wasn't having it.
Who do you think you are? You've got no right to come barging in here like this.
This gives me all the right I need.
The robber waved his gun around.
Now you just stay in your seat and be quiet, and you won't get hurt.
The hell I will.
Exhibiting more guts than sense, the man stood up. When he did, the robber brought the butt of his pistol down hard on the top of the man's head. The passenger fell back in the seat with his head bleeding.
Keep quiet! Everyone just keep quiet and stay in your seats!
Another gunman came in to join the first.
What happened?
Nothing I can't handle. Is everything under control out there?
Yeah, everyone is doing just what you told them. Sims is covering the engineer and Beardsley's going through one of the other cars.
Peters, you dumb son of a bitch! You just told everyone on the train our names!
Sorry, Martin, I wasn't thinking.
No, you'd need a brain for that, wouldn't you? Just start with the car behind us.
All right.
As the second gunman started down the aisle to go to the next car, he looked over and saw the badge on John Henry's shirt.
Hey, Martin!
He brought his gun around toward John Henry.
We got us a lawman on board.
John Henry had intended to wait for a few minutes longer until he was able to get a better grasp of the situation, but his hand had been cold. Peters was already pulling the hammer back on his pistol. John Henry blasted a hole through his own hat. The gunman who'd recognized him went down with a hole in his chest. The gunman up front, the one called Martin, managed to get off a shot, but he was shooting fast and wild. John Henry, his hat now discarded, brought his own pistol up. Hit in the chest, Martin fell against the front wall of the car, then slid down until he was sitting on the floor. On the wall behind him, a swath of blood traced his path downward. Martin clasped his hands over his wound, but blood began spilling through his fingers. Pulling his hand away, he looked at his bloody palm for a second, then his head fell to one side. Two men had come into the car, and two men had died. The car filled with the gun smoke of the three discharges. John Henry scooted out through the back door of the car. He jumped from the steps down to the ground and fell and rolled out into the darkness.
Martin! Peters! What's going on in there? What's going on?
By the train's ambient light, John Henry saw the train robber who was yelling at the others. This was the same one who was covering the engineer. Now he moved quickly toward the back of the train. As he ran through the little golden patches of light, it had the effect of a lantern blinking on and off, so that first he was in shadow, then brightly illuminated, then shadow, then illuminated. John Henry aimed at him.
Hold it right there. I'm a United States Marshal. Throw down your gun and put up your hands.
Realizing he was standing in a patch of light, the robber moved out into the shadow. He was out of the light, but the muzzle flash of his pistol gave John Henry an ideal target. John Henry's bullet found its mark.
Sim, I'm hit!
The robber collapsed. John Henry had accounted for three.
Sims, you may as well come on out of there. All the others are dead. You're the only one left. You don't have anywhere to go.
Who the hell are you anyway?
The name is Six Killer.
Six Killer? Yeah, I've heard of you. You're that Indian policeman, ain't you? What are you doing here?
I'm a U.S. Marshal.
What the hell? How'd you hear we was going to rob it?
A medicine man told me.
I'm coming out. Don't shoot, Six Killer. I'm coming out.
Well, come on, then.
John Henry watched the back door of the private car. A second later, it opened, and Sims appeared. But instead of coming out with his hands up, as John Henry had expected him to do, he had Beam with him, and he was holding his pistol to Beam's head.
You out here, Six Killer? You out here?
I'm here.
John Henry stepped out so the outlaw could see him, and he raised his pistol to point it at Sims.
Drop your gun and come on down here.
Drop my gun? Are you crazy? Maybe you ain't noticed, but I got my gun pointed right straight at this man's head.
Why?
Why? 'Cause he's my ticket out of here, that's why. I figure he must be someone important, else he wouldn't be riding in a private car. And I don't reckon you'd like to see his brains blowed out now, would you?
To be honest about it, Sims, I don't even know the man, so I really don't care one way or the other. The business between us has nothing to do with him. You may as well let him go.
Ha! Let him go? The hell I will! Don't you understand, Marshal? I aim to shoot this man.
Put your gun down and your hands up, Sims. That's the only way you're going to get out of here alive.
No, it ain't the only way I'm going to get out of here. It's like I told you, I got me an ace up the sleeve.
And what is your ace?
What the hell do you mean, what is my ace? Damn it, man, are you blind? Can't you see that I got this man here?
Yes, I can see that you've got that man and that you're holding your gun to his head. But my question is, what is that supposed to mean to me?
Just how dumb are you anyway? What it means is, if you don't drop your gun, I'm going to shoot him. And I ain't bluffing. Are you listening to what I'm saying, Marshal?
All right, do it.
What?
What?
I said do it. Shoot him now so you and I can get down to business.
Are you crazy?
I'm an Indian. What does a white man mean to me? Go ahead, do it. Shoot him. And once he's gone, it'll just be the two of us.
You're bluffing.
If you don't shoot him, I will. Then I'll shoot you.
John Henry moved the barrel of his gun slightly so that he was now aiming it at Beam. By now, several of the passengers had detrained, and they were standing out in the darkness, watching as this drama played out before them.
What's it going to be, Sims? Are you going to shoot him, or am I?
You son of a bitch! You're crazy, you know that? You're crazy!
In angry frustration, Sims pushed Beam away and aimed at John Henry. John Henry's shot knocked Sims back against the door of the car before he collapsed in a heap onto the vestibule floor.
You all right, Mr. Beam?
He was still holding his pistol out in front of him, and smoke curled up from the end of the barrel.
Yes, I'm fine, thank you. Would you really have shot me, Marshal?
What do you think?
Well, for a minute or two there, I thought maybe you would shoot me.
Good.
Good?
If you thought I was going to shoot you, then Sims was thinking the same thing.
Ho, ho, ho. I owe you my life. Now, I wonder if you would do me the honor of accepting my invitation to finish this trip as my guest in my private car.
John Henry thought that as a public servant, he should probably decline. But he had never ridden in a private car before, and it was highly unlikely he would ever get the opportunity to ride in one again. He smiled at the invitation.
I'd be glad to.
As the train wheels clacked rhythmically beneath him, John Henry noticed that Mr. Beam's car rocked much more gently than the rough-riding car he had been in. Beam poured a drink at a small bar in the corner and handed it to John Henry. Over the course of his life, John Henry had drunk just about every type of alcohol available. He had drunk beer that was so green he could still taste the yeast, and whiskey that was aged with rusty nails and flavored with tobacco juice. Once he had even drunk champagne, but never had he tasted anything like the sipping whiskey he drank now.
Do you like it?
I do indeed.
John Henry's answer wasn't adequate to express how much he really did like it, but he never was a man for words.
My grandfather, David Beam, started our whiskey business. This is Jim Beam, named after my father, and a product of our finest line.
How did you get from the whiskey business into the railroad business?
Well, I'm not in either, actually. My father and my brother are running the distillery, and I am but an investor in the railroad. I have an equal investment in the Katy line, by the way.
Well, there's nothing like covering your bet.
My sentiments exactly.
It was nearly midnight by the time the train reached Baxter Springs. But you couldn't tell it by the amount of activity. The railroad workers in the town were still celebrating the fact that they had reached the border ahead of the Katy. John Henry stepped down from the private car and looked around at the ongoing celebration on the platform all around him. When he looked toward the baggage car of the train, he saw that the four bodies had been taken down and laid out side by side at the far end of the platform. Already the curious gathered around to look down at the four dead men. John Henry walked into the End of Track Saloon, the most substantial-looking building in a row of ramshackle shacks and tents, and the closest establishment to a hotel one could find in the town, providing the sporting women weren't using all the rooms. Because all the chimneys of all the lanterns were soot-covered, what light there was inside was dingy and filtered through drifting smoke. The place smelled of whiskey, stale beer, and sour tobacco. There was a long bar on the left, with dirty towels hanging on hooks about every 5 feet along the front. A large mirror hung behind the bar, but like everything else about the saloon, it was so dirty John Henry could scarcely see any images in it, and what he could see was distorted by imperfections in the glass.
Yes, sir. By the time this railroad goes through engine territory, then on through Texas, why, this here town will be the biggest town in Kansas.
Biggest town in Kansas? Hell, it'll more than likely be one of the biggest cities west of the Mississippi. There'll be St. Louis, Denver, San Francisco, and Baxter Springs. Mark my words.
Out on the floor of the saloon sat eight tables, nearly all of them occupied. A half dozen or so bar girls flitted about, pushing drinks and promising more for the right price. A few card games were in progress, but most of the patrons were just drinking and talking. Two subjects of conversation dominated the room, one being the railroad reaching the border, and the other, the gunfight that took place in this same saloon earlier in the day. But by now they had also heard of what had taken place on the train, and already there was speculation as to which of the two victors was the best.
In my mind, there ain't no doubt. The marshal took on four men. Four, mind you, and he killed all four. You can't compare that with Matt Dixon killing just one man.
The hell you can't. That marshal done his killing in the dark. Dixon called Luber out and stood up to him face to face. And did you see Dixon's draw? faster than greased lightning it was. Why, it was that quick, I never seen nothing more than a jump of his shoulder, and the gun was in his hand and blazing, and Lube was grabbing his chest and falling down, already deader than a doornail without getting off even one shot.
Still, 4-1.
Hoo-wee! Wouldn't you love to see them two go against one another?
Which one you think would get killed?
Six killer for sure.
Oh, I don't think so. I think Six Killer's the one to do the killing.
The men carrying on the conversation had no idea the subject of their conversation stood right there in the room with them. When John Henry stepped up to the bartender was pouring the residue from abandoned whiskey glasses back into a bottle. He pulled a soggy cigar butt from one glass, laid the butt aside, then poured the whiskey back into the bottle without qualms. John Henry held up his finger.
Yeah?
I'd like a room.
There ain't no rooms.
I was told you had rooms for the whores to use.
That's right. We do have rooms, but they're for the women.
Do they use the rooms alone?
What?
When someone buys a whore's time, does the whore go into the room alone?
No, of course not.
Then I want a room with a whore.
Why didn't you say so in the first place? Which one do you want?
I don't care.
You've got to have a choice.
Pick one.
You're joshing me.
No, you choose one.
The bartender looked over at a woman who was standing alone at the end of the bar. She was clearly older than any of the other women, and there was a drained look about her. She stood alone, nursing a beer.
Susie! And this man wants you.
Susie smiled at John Henry, but the tiredness didn't leave her eyes.
You have a room?
The woman sidled up to John Henry.
Yeah, of course I have a room.
How much if I spend the whole night with you?
The whole night? You want to spend an entire night with me?
Yes.
Well, it'll be midnight in another few minutes, so only be half price then if you want to wait.
John Henry pulled out a silver dollar and handed it to her.
Why wait?
Mister, are you serious? You're willing to pay full price now instead of waiting no more than 5 minutes?
Yes.
Susie led John Henry up the stairs, then down the hall to her room. It was very small, only slightly larger than the bed.
I'll, get us a towel.
We won't need one.
What do you mean?
I'm tired, Susie. To be honest with you, I came up here for the bed. All I want to do is sleep. I hope you don't mind.
Mind? Mister, I could kiss you. You don't know how wonderful it would be for me to just sleep all night.
She smiled, showing two missing teeth.
And get paid for it besides.
A photograph of a young girl lay on the chest. Susie saw John Henry looking at it.
That's my little girl. She lives with my sister back in Kansas City. She doesn't know I'm her mother, and I don't ever want her to know.
She's very pretty.
Yep, and sweet.
The smile left Susie's face.
She can't know who her mother is, or what I do for a living.
You love her?
Yeah, I do. Very much.
Any child who has a mother's love is lucky.
He sat on the edge of the bed and started to remove his boots.
Wait. At least let me take your boots off for you.
Susie turned around, straddled one of John Henry's legs, then pulled off the boot. She did the same with his other boots.
Thanks.
John Henry lay back on the bed and was soon unconscious. Susie lay down beside him, and they both slept soundly until the sun came up. John Henry awakened the next morning to the aroma of freshly brewed coffee. When he opened his eyes, he saw Susie putting a coffee pot, two cups, and a plate of biscuits on the chest.
Coffee and biscuits. Not much of a breakfast, I admit. But I thought it might hold you till you can get a proper breakfast in you.
Susie, it is a wonderful breakfast. Even more so because I'll be able to share it with you.
Susie's smile was almost a blush, and for just a moment, the tiredness in her eyes went away. John Henry moved over to the window and pulled the curtain to one side as he looked down on the street. The street was full of men and women who seemed to be celebrating.
What's going on down there?
I imagine they're still celebrating that the railroad reached the border. They don't know yet that they haven't really reached it.
John Henry looked at Susie in surprise. That was exactly what he had heard when he met with Colonel Stevens, Stan Watty, and others of the Katy Railroad. He didn't know that anyone here realized that, though. 15 minutes later, John Henry was down on the side of the street, watching the celebration. When the passenger who stood up to the robbers on the train spotted John Henry, he smiled and came over to him, bandaged head and all.
What's the celebration about?
Two things. We are celebrating that the railroad has reached Indian territory. And, of course, you are also the cause of our celebration.
How am I the cause of it?
I take it you haven't gone down to look at the display on the porch of the general store.
No.
Go take a look, Mr. Sixkiller. I think you'll be proud.
Finishing his biscuit, John Henry walked down toward the general store. Several people, men, women, and children, stood around the front porch looking at some sort of display. John Henry moved in closer.
My God.
There, in four wooden coffins standing up against the wall, reposed the bodies of the men who tried to hold up the train the night before. All four outlaws were shirtless, so the bullet holes that killed them could be clearly seen.
Hi, everyone! Here's the fella that killed these outlaws!
It's Marshal Sixkiller! Three cheers for the Marshal! Hip, hip,
hooray!
Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip,
hooray!
John Henry held up his hand to silence them, then walked up for a closer look at a hand-lettered sign propped up at the front of the coffins.
Here are the bodies of four bandits killed by United States Marshal John Henry Sixkiller. These outlaws were killed when they tried to rob a border tier train.
Tahlequah. Marcus Eberwine cracked a raw egg, then dropped it into his beer. He swirled it around a couple of times and then drank it down. Ah! Willie Buck shook his head.
How can you do that?
That's good for you.
Anyway, Deckard said you wanted to see me.
Yeah. It seems that John Henry Sixkiller, our own intrepid Indian policeman, chief sheriff, and now United States Marshal, has been personally assigned to keep a watch on the progress of the railroads as they approach Indian territory.
Yes, that's what I've heard.
Well, I propose that we take advantage of that.
Pardon me, but you don't know what you're talking about. I can't imagine anyone in the whole of the Indian Territory less likely to be taken advantage of than John Henry Sixkiller.
No. We won't be taking advantage of him. We will be taking advantage of the situation. And this is the way we'll do it.
Everyone passed Willie Buck a letter.
From the office of William Ross, President of the Cherokee, to Marcus Eberwine. Mr. Eberwine, it has been approved by the President and Council of the Eastern Cherokee, in session assembled, to accept your generous offer to act as liaison between the Eastern Cherokee and the Katy Railroad, and between the Eastern Cherokee and the Border Tier Railroad. The two companies currently engage in the effort to be the first into Indian Territory. This liaison is to be provided without prejudice with regard to the separate railroads until such time as one of the railroads shall succeed in crossing into Indian territory. At that time, you will represent the President and the Council of the Cherokee. William Ross, Chief and President, Eastern Cherokee. What does that mean?
That means that John Henry Sixkiller will be working for me. Be he United States Marshal or not. And as soon as the winning railroad enters the territory, he will be required to report to me for further instructions.
Eberwine, you won't be able to tell him to stop the construction or even to slow it down.
No, nor is that my intention. We'll be monitoring the progress through him, which will give us an inside position on how best to combat it.
How will that work?
Oh, you just leave that to me. From here on, I think it would not be good for us to be seen together. After all, you are chairman of the Indian Independence Council. You'll be fighting against the construction until the United States grants the independence of the new nation of Sequoia. And because of my involvement with the railroad, I will be able to tell you where your attacks will be most effective.
Yes. Yes, that is a very good idea. It's like I always say, Eberwine, you are a very smart man.
Well, I like to think so.
Eberwine poured a beer for Buck, then refreshed his own. He held his glass out in a toast.
How soon do I start?
As soon as I learn which railroad will be our most likely target.
As Eberwine and Willie Buck discussed the tactics they would use to stop the railroad, Colonel Stevens sat in Emporia holding a conference with his chief officers.
I want a work train made up right away. Put my private car on it, right behind the engine and tender. Load the train with as much building material as you can get on it, and let's move everything to end of track.
Otis Gunn nodded.
All right, boss.
We are going to be the first railroad into Indian territory come hell or high water. The success or failure of this operation will be determined in the next 2 weeks. Millions of dollars are at stake. Millions.
I'll get the train loaded right away.
Despite Gunn's promise of right away, it took 24 hours to load the train with rails, cross ties, bridge timbers, spikes, and fish plates. When the train was loaded and Stevens' private car, which was named the Prairie Queen, was attached, they got underway. The length of the train and the heavy load it was carrying meant that it could barely manage a speed of 10 miles per hour. Because of that, it took 9 hours to get from Emporia to Humboldt. There, the train was pulled off to a siding where it spent the night. The next day, the train passed through Cherryvale and 30 miles beyond to the end of track. It was raining when the train reached the end of track, and not just a gentle rain. The rain was coming down in torrents, with streams of water rushing alongside the track.
Colonel, when you said come hell or high water, you weren't kidding. Here's the high water for you. It's raining hard enough to drown frogs.
Well, that may be so, Otis, but we aren't frogs. Let's go see what's going on.
The two men strode down the track.
There's nobody working. Where the hell is everybody?
I imagine they're staying out of the rain.
Why? They aren't made of sugar. They aren't going to melt.
Walking 100 feet or so beyond the end of track, Stevens saw that a very large bridge rested on timber standing in a creek. The bridge was not yet secured, even though it was raining hard and the creek was rising.
Look at that. Damn it. That bridge isn't secured and the water is running faster than bloody hell. It's going to push the bridge off the piling.
Even as he was talking, some of the top tier of the timbers worked loose, then started floating rapidly downstream.
We've got to stop that. If we lose that bridge, it'll cost us days.
John Scullin, upon seeing the train arrive, now came up to greet Stevens.
Colonel, we weren't expecting you here today.
Obviously not. We are about to lose that bridge, and not one man is out there working. Not one.
Colonel, you can't expect a man to work in conditions like this.
I can expect them, and I do expect them. Where are they? And please don't tell me they've gone back to Humboldt.
Oh, no, sir. They're here. Every one of them.
Skellen pointed at 4 rather substantial tents.
They're all inside the tents, out of the rain.
Stevens started toward the tents, splashing through the mud puddles, some of which were knee-deep. As Scullin had said, all of the workmen had taken shelter from the rain. They were in tents, playing cards, talking, and napping.
What are you men doing in here? Why aren't you working?
Colonel, it's raining too hard. You can't work in rain like this.
Who says you can't? You have to.
Stevens pointed to the bridge.
Don't you understand that if you don't get this bridge secured, it can wash away? If we lose that bridge, it'll take nearly a week to get it put back again.
That's a possibility. But Colonel, what can we do about it? Especially in weather like this.
I have hired the best engineer and the best construction foreman in the business, and they are here with you. I'm sure that under their direction, you can find some way to secure that bridge. I am so sure of it that I will give a $20 bonus to anyone who will work until this bridge is secured.
$20?
Yes, $20. And you won't have to wait till the next payday to get your money. I'll give it to you as soon as the bridge is secured.
I don't know about the rest of these folks, Colonel, but you got me.
The man began putting on his poncho. Within 5 minutes, 25 men had agreed to the offer, and they came out of the tents, grabbed their tools, and headed for the bridge. If they were harboring any hope for the rain to ease up, it was a false hope. The rain increased in intensity. The men began working in almost impossible conditions. They would get a timber in place, but before they could secure it, it would wash away in a swirling pool, sometimes taking one or more of the men with it. One of the workers was knocked down when a heavy timber hit him in the head. He started floating away, belly down, face underwater. It was Scullin who saved him from drowning, racing after him, picking him up from the water, and to the cheers of the others, throwing him across his shoulder and bringing him back to safety. Another man got a broken arm, and several others received painful bruises and cuts, but the men did not stop working. They toiled in a constant downpour, working by lanterns once it grew dark, even though the rain fell so hard that it was difficult to keep the lanterns lit, even with the storm shutters. Finally, at midnight, both Scullin and Gunn inspected the bridge and declared that it was secure and sound. By 7 o'clock the next morning, the crew was at work again. Thankfully, the rain had stopped, though the way that had been prepared for the tracks was underwater, and much of the grating had washed away. Compared to the Herculean effort of the night before, though, laying the tracks up to and across the bridge seemed almost child's play. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the tracks crossed the bridge and were laid for 1,000 feet beyond. It was now time to test the bridge.
We'll run the train across as soon as we can unload it.
And why are you going to unload it?
Scullin shook his head.
Why, to lighten the load, of course.
We're gonna need the material to go on from here, aren't we?
Oh, yes, of course.
Then I see no reason to lighten the load. We're going to need the material, and we need to know if the bridge is going to hold up. If it will hold up for this load, it will hold up for anything.
I don't know, that seems like quite a risk to me. If the bridge collapses under the load, we'll have a wrecked train and scattered material that might take 2 weeks or longer to clean up.
I think the bridge will hold up.
Stephen scratched his chin and looked at the bridge.
John, how confident are you that the bridge will hold up? Because Otis is right. If the bridge collapses under the load, I'm ruined. It won't make any difference if it is 2 days or 2 weeks. The Katie won't recover.
Colonel, I'll tell you how confident I am. I'll ride up on the boiler. If the bridge gives way and the engine crashes, that boiler is going to explode and I'll be cooked like a Christmas goose.
You are that sure of it, are you?
Aye, yes, sir, I am.
Well, you don't have to ride on the boiler. Let's just cross our fingers and send it across.
Yes, sir.
With steam in the boiler and Stephen's gun and Scullin riding in Stephen's car, the engineer pulled on the throttle as the anxious workers watched the train start slowly toward the bridge. The workmen hurried to both sides of the creek, watching as the train approached.
She's on it!
The shout wasn't necessary. Everyone could see that the engine had eased out onto the bridge. It rolled across, and anxious eyes studied the rails and the timbers for any unwanted activity. The bridge held solid as the train rolled across. Once the last car had cleared the bridge, the engineer pulled the whistle cord. In Stevens' private car, he poured 3 glasses of whiskey, then held his glass up, joined by the others. They drank a toast. Then Stevens pulled out his pocket watch and checked the time.
We crossed the last major obstacle at 4:03 p.m. Gentlemen, I have never felt more confident than now that we will be the first railroad across the border.
John Henry set off for Indian Territory to meet with Marcus Eberwine. According to Marshal Sarber, who gave John Henry his assignment, Eberwine had been appointed by the Cherokee Council to be the chief liaison between the Indians and whichever railroad won the race to come into Indian Territory. Left up to John Henry, Eberwine would not have received the appointment. John Henry knew Eberwine, a businessman who employed a lot of Indians. He had a lot of people depending on him for their living. But John Henry believed Eberwine took advantage of his position of power within the Cherokee Nation by charging exorbitant prices on goods he brought in by his freight wagons. Shortly after John Henry entered Indian Territory, he saw a disturbing sign. The sign stood alongside the right-of-way that would be granted for whichever railroad first crossed the border into Indian Territory.
Warning to the White Man's Railroad, we don't want you. Stay out of our land. Indian Independence Council.
He looked around to see if anyone was monitoring the sign. He knew that during the war, Willie Buck created something called the Indian Independence Council, which he claimed was fighting for the total independence of the Indian Territory from both the Union and the Confederacy. After the war, Willie Buck made a big thing about surrendering to the Union Army, to earn parole, along with all the other rebel commanders. But that was during the war. He didn't know of any activity by the Indian Independence Council since the war ended. Nonetheless, he was sure Willie Buck had something to do with it, but decided to check with Captain LaFlores. John Henry rode up to a building that served as the Cherokee government offices. Here was the office of President William Ross. Here, too, was where the two houses of the Cherokee government assembled when they held session. Captain LaFlores, who was chief of the Indian police, had his office here as well. And it was to LaFlores that John Henry reported.
Hello, John Henry. Or should I say Marshal Sixkiller?
A smiling LaFlores rose from his desk.
Captain?
John Henry touched the brim of his hat.
What brings you to Tahlequah? Not that I'm not pleased to see you, you understand.
You mean you don't know?
No. Should I know something?
Maybe not. I just thought you might. I've been summoned back to meet with Marcus Eberwine.
Marcus Eberwine? What do you mean, summoned back? What are you supposed to meet with him about?
I'm told that he's been appointed as liaison between the Cherokee and the railroad.
Damn, I hadn't heard that. I was hoping you were here to arrest the son of a bitch on some charge. To which railroad will he be a liaison?
At the moment, it's not specific. I expect he'll be liaison to whichever railroad is first into the territory. As yet, we don't know which that will be, but my guess is that it will be the Katy.
Who appointed Eberwine? The railroads?
Nope. It is my understanding that he was appointed by President Ross.
William Ross. He wouldn't make a pimple on his father's ass. How in heaven's name he became our chief, I will never know.
It was the council.
Yes.
Captain LaFlores, what do you know of the Indian Independence Council?
Indian Independence Council? You mean that outfit that Willie Buck started during the war? What about it?
Is it active again? I mean, have you heard anything about it?
No, I haven't heard anything. Why do you ask?
When I first came into the territory, I saw a sign that said the Indians did not want the railroad, and it warned the railroads to stay out. The sign was posted by the Indian Independence Council.
Oh, that's nonsense. Why wouldn't they want the railroad here? It'll benefit the entire territory.
Yes, I would have thought so, too. But apparently, Willie Buck is against it. That is, assuming he's affiliated with the Indian Independence Council.
Well, I tell you the truth, I wouldn't put it past the son of a bitch. He's certainly ornery enough. But why he'd be against the railroad, I have no idea. I'm glad you told me about it, though. It sounds as if it might be a group that could cause us trouble. I'll get the police to keep a lookout for it to see if we can actually find out who they are and what they have planned.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
LaFlores looked at John Henry and shook his head.
What is it?
You've come a long way from the young man who wanted nothing more than to avenge your father's murder. You've become the best policeman on the force, rose to chief sheriff, and now here you stand, the United States Marshal. You're a fine lawman, John Henry.
I had a good teacher. You.
You give me too much credit, John Henry.
I'd like to give credit where credit is due.
Well, I appreciate that. And you do me a favor, will you? Watch yourself dealing with Eberwine. I know he's a big man in the territory. He employs a lot of people. He's got a lot of money. But I've never trusted him. And if he's involved in the railroad business, well, I just don't believe he's up to any good.
Thanks for the warning. I'll keep my eyes open.
Leaving the office of his friend, John Henry rode down to the far end of town, where he saw a neatly painted white building with green trim. A large sign crowned the building, declaring it the office of the Eberwine Freight Company. Behind the building lay the freight yard, a great, enclosed lot of at least 5 acres. Half of the lot served as corral for scores of mules. The other half held more than a dozen freight wagons, some ready to go, a few up on stands with one or more wheels removed as they underwent maintenance. Eberwine looked up from his desk.
Marshal, it was good of you to accept the invitation to come.
It was a bit more than an invitation. I'm just following orders.
Perhaps so, but I am glad you are here.
And I see no reason to make our visit all business, though of course we will discuss business. But first, we may as well enjoy the meeting, hmm? I thought you might be here in time for lunch, so I've had my cook prepare a meal for us. We'll visit and discuss this railroad situation.
If John Henry had expected something like a ham sandwich or perhaps some cold chicken, he was very much mistaken. Across the office, he saw a table covered with a crisp white tablecloth, set with shining silver candelabra and place settings, classic china, and delicate crystal stemware. The lunch, served by a white-coated server, consisted of tinned oysters, freshly caught trout, baked sweet potatoes, wine, and canned peaches in heavy cream. John Henry picked at his meal, while Eberwine consumed his with great gusto, so enjoying his eating that he didn't even notice John Henry barely touched his food. After the meal was over and the white-jacketed server cleared away the table, Eberwine suggested that they move to another part of the room where two overstuffed oxblood leather chairs faced each other, separated by a small round table. There were papers on the table, at least one of which, John Henry noticed, was a map. Another servant, this time a very attractive young woman, approached the two men carrying a small wooden box. When she reached them, she opened the box, displaying its contents. At least 24 aromatic cigars.
These are from Cuba, and you must try them.
Eberwine took one out and handed it to the woman. She used a silver cutter to snip the tips. Then she licked the side, handed the cigar to Eberwine, and held a match under it. As he puffed, the end glowed red, and the smoke enwreathed his head. She took a second cigar out and snipped the tips, but before she licked the side, John Henry shook his head and reached for it. She lit his cigar as well.
I think it's absolutely uncivilized to discuss business in any way other than in the convivial atmosphere of good cigar smoke.
It is a good cigar.
Eberwine puffed, then studied the end of his cigar for a moment.
Yeah. Tell me, Marshal, you've been a part of this railroad operation for some time now. Which one do you think will be the first to reach the border?
John Henry had his own belief about which one he thought would be first, and he shared that idea with Captain LaFlores, but he had no intention of sharing it with Eberwine. At least not until he had some feel of what Eberwine's role was in this operation.
I don't know the answer to that. I'm a lawman, not a railroad man. Both of them are building as quickly as they can, and at the moment, my lawman's guess would put them about even.
But surely you have an idea of who's in the lead, or at least who you think might win. I don't wish to breach any agreement of confidentiality you may have with him, but, well, I think it would make my job easier.
What exactly is your job, Mr. Eberwine?
Oh, I thought you knew. I'm to be the liaison between the railroad and the Cherokee people. But I don't know exactly what that will entail until I know which railroad I'll have to deal with.
Have to deal with? You say that as if you aren't welcoming a railroad into Indian Territory.
On the contrary, sir, who would not welcome the railroad and the prosperity it's sure to bring to all of us?
Evidently, some don't want the railroad.
Oh, you'd be talking about the Indian Independence Council?
Eberwine's mention of the Indian Independence Council surprised John Henry.
You mean you know about them?
Well, yes, of course I've heard of them. They've certainly announced their displeasure with the idea of a railroad coming into the Indian Territory.
It's strange that you would know that when Captain LaFlores did not.
Are you telling me that the captain of the Indian police is unaware of the opposition of the Indian Independence Council to the railroad? My, well, that doesn't give one much confidence in our police, does it? I mean, you know about it, and you aren't even one of us.
One of us?
Well, I meant that figuratively, of course. I mean, of course, you are Cherokee, even though you are no longer a full-time resident of the territory, being as you are a United States Marshal. And I'm not Cherokee, though my heart is certainly with the Cherokee Nation. But tell me, How is it that you know about their opposition to the railroad and LaFloris does not?
I wouldn't have known about it if I hadn't seen a sign they posted. I know the Indian Independence Council was something Willie Buck put together in order to justify his looting during the war. I didn't know he was still involved with it.
Do you think it's Willie Buck?
Who else would it be?
Yes, yeah, who else indeed? But you are right about their opposition to the railroad. I got a letter of demand from them as soon as it was announced in the Cherokee Advocate that I was to be the railroad liaison. I do know, though, that it's composed of a group of Indians and not just Cherokee who want the Indian Territory to be independent from the United States. As I understand it, they want to establish a separate nation. A nation to be called, Sequoia, I believe.
Do you still have that letter?
Yes, yeah, would you like to see it?
I would, if you don't mind.
My first thought upon getting it was to tear it up, throw it away.
Walking over to his desk, Eberwine pulled open one of the drawers and removed the letter, then brought it back to John Henry.
As you will see when you read it, it is quite belligerent. But upon second thought, I decided to keep it, just in case they decided to act upon one of their threats and someone in authority might want to see it.
John Henry nodded as he took the letter and began to read.
Dear Mr. Eberwine, we, the members of the Indian Independence Council, have read with interest the news of your appointment as railroad liaison. The railroad must not and will not be built. Be warned. We will not stand by and allow any further incursion by the white man into our lands until such time as we have gained full and complete independence from the collection of states that call themselves the United States of America. In your capacity as liaison, we caution you to order the railroads currently under construction to halt at the border. Any attempt made by the railroad to cross into Indian territory will be resisted by violence if necessary. Once our independence is gained, we will build a railroad system through our new nation, and at that time, enter into agreements with American railroads that will allow trade and commerce. Any attempt to build a railroad before our independence is gained and agreements made will end in disaster. Sincerely, Indian Independence Council, Willie Buck, President.
I'm surprised he signed it.
Oh, I think he fashions himself a patriot. I'm sure he's quite sincere in wanting the territory to secede.
We tried to secede once before, and it brought us nothing but trouble.
Yes, of course. The recent unpleasantness when the five civilized nations opted to secede from the Union and join the Confederacy. That wasn't a very smart move, I will admit. But this isn't anything like that. What the Indian Independence Council wants, as I understand it, is complete independence, not to be affiliated with any other country, to be a nation unto itself.
That wouldn't be a very wise thing to do. In the first place, we would be completely landlocked by states and territories of the United States. What sort of independence would that be? Besides, even if these people are serious about secession again and make a declaration of independence, wouldn't it make sense to support the railroad rather than oppose it? A railroad would give us a connection to the outside world.
Yes, but I think their point is that the white man would own the railroad. And I believe they want us to own the railroad.
Us?
Well, again, now I am speaking figuratively. I meant, of course, that they want the Indians to own the railroad.
Eberwine walked John Henry to the door.
Well, I'm sure, Marshal, that with you on the job, we will have no difficulty in bringing the railroad to the Indian Territory.
I appreciate your confidence, Mr. Eberwine.
Oh, and now how can I not be confident? You've made quite a name for yourself as a U.S. Marshal, and before that, as an Indian policeman.
As I said, I appreciate your confidence.
After John Henry Sixkiller left his office, Eberwine walked over to stand in front of the window and watch as the Marshal mounted his horse and rode away.
You can come out now, Mr. Dixon. He's gone.
Matt Dixon had been hiding in a back room of Eberwine's office, peeping through a crack at the U.S. Marshal as he met with Eberwine. As Dixon came out of the back room, he walked over to the desk, without invitation, to take a handful of Eberwine's cigars. In a world without guns, the small, almost anemic Dixon would scarcely get noticed. But this world lived by guns, and Dixon had two attributes that served him well in his chosen profession as a hired gun. He was fast, he was accurate. Still, many gunfighters were fast and accurate. Dixon possessed an additional character trait that made him a man to be feared by even the fastest and most skilled. Dixon could kill without compunction. Dixon could take a man's life with no more thought than he would give to stepping one foot in front of another. Eberwine sent for Dixon, intending to hire him, but even Eberwine felt uneasy in his presence. He winced as Dixon put at least five of the expensive cigars in a pocket. He prepared to light one, causing Eberwine to wince again as he scratched a match across Eberwine's desk.
Is that the man you want me to kill?
Well, now, I wouldn't exactly put it that way.
Dixon squinted at him through tobacco smoke.
No? How would you put it?
I want him out of the way so he won't interfere with my plans.
If he's dead, he's out of the way.
Yes. Yes, I suppose if you put it that way, but I'm not going to tell you how to do it. I just want him out of the way.
It's going to cost you $1,500.
$1,500? Are you serious?
I'm very serious. I know that you can afford it, Eberwine.
I only paid Percy Martin $500.
Uh-huh. And how did that work out? Martin's dead, isn't he?
Yes.
You get what you pay for. I'm going to cost you $1,500. $750 now, and another $750 when Sixkiller is out of the way.
All right, I'll give you what you ask. I just want the job done.